This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
This is the Book Riot Podcast. It's a weekly news and talk show about what's new, cool, and worth talking about in the world of books and reading. Today's Thursday, July 13th, 2023. Rebecca Shinsky joins me. I join her. We join together to bring you news of banning and censorship in North America in the year of our Lord 2023.
And a little Britney Spears news, just for good measure.
Yeah. A tough week in the world of books and reading, I would say. Not a lot of good stuff. Though, maybe some good news out of Pennsylvania. Bad news, I know you're going to be shocked.
Out of Mississippi.
Out of Florida and Mississippi. Before we do that, I want to point your attention to other places you can hear me talking to microphones, or another place in specific. A new episode of First Edition came out this morning. Liberty Hardy joined me, and I did a thing I usually do to Rebecca, but I needed someone to be nicer to me than Rebecca would, and you're very nice to me. But I really put my vulnerability out there, and my secret that I confess to Liberty is I don't enjoy author interviews, generally speaking. But authors are interesting, and I would like to do more talking to authors, but I do not want to interview them about their book.
Agreed.
Because, and you'll hear Lib and I talk about this, if you're interested in going over there, First Edition, you can find it where you get your podcast. We'll be in the show notes. Especially when it comes to a podcasting format, because when someone subscribes to your podcast, they're trusting you to give them something interesting. And to a first approximation, a new book that's out, zero people have read it. It's not actually zero, but it might as well be zero. So it's different even than an author event at a bookstore where people come to that for that author. Like, you know what you're getting into. We're asking something different if people fire up our show. It's like, we're not asking you to do homework. We're asking you to give us a chance to trust us with your time, or at least that you're going to get something that you're going to find interesting. And I don't typically find authors talking about a book I haven't read to be that interesting. Nonfiction's a little bit different because you can talk about an idea and you can learn something there. But especially when it's a novel, especially debut fiction, I don't know the author at all. So I offered Liberty 15 ideas I had for talking about talking to an author, and then asked her to tell me what she thought of them. Because she's done a lot of this. She cares as much as anyone I know about talking about new books. She's done a lot of this herself. And we had a really good time. And I think I got some real ideas. So go check that out over there on First Edition. And I've got some good people booked. I've got some coming up I'm really excited about. I don't want to spoil it. So I'm just going to tease it. But someone that has won multiple major awards is coming on the show in August on First Edition. I will say this, if you like my old Reading Live show, it's a Reading Live format with a multiple major award winner. I'm very, very excited to do. So go check out First Edition. Is that enough of a plug? I pretty plugged it. I didn't plug it. I got out a shovel and dug a hole and then buried everyone in it.
We were assigned by the folks who do audience development to talk about First Edition, and you have succeeded in talking about it. That was a good plug. I think Liberty was the perfect conversation partner for that particular question. She is nicer than I am, but I'm sure your ideas were good too. So yeah, I'll look forward to listening.
So anyway, thanks for that, and look for more for First Edition. Just a programming note for people following along with that. Rebecca is still going to come on every month. At either the very end of the month to talk about the next one or the very beginning of that month to do It Books. We're going to continue that. I'm committing to two episodes a month, but as I'm getting guests, there may be some bonus episodes. I was thinking about doing it weekly by the fall. Some other stuff has come up, so I'm still holding it back, but it's going to be at least twice a month with, I think, maybe at least one more episode per month through the fall, because we're in the height. I mean, there's a billion books coming out. Liberty was saying that she thinks 2023 is the best year for books in 15 years since 2008.
Well, she would know. She reads more books than anybody.
She would know. On the other hand, Lib always has a great time with her reading.
That's true.
So I'm not sure if she's the worst or the best evaluator of the year
maybe
books,
a little of both. I have been feeling like we're in kind of a TikTok, not the app, but the clock sense of kind of every other year, I end the year thinking like, man, this year was rich in good books. And 2021 was one of those. The fall of 2023 is looking like it's very likely to be.
Very good.
So
very good.
I don't even remember what I read in 2008. That's amazing.
Well, didn't we do the power ranking? Isn't that the one that got us going?
No, that was 2000. We did the 2000. Yeah.
Oh, Kendra and I were talking about 2008 for audiobooks. Mm. That's why 2008. Okay. So that was a previous edition of First Edition where Kendra Winchester, who covers audiobooks for us at Book Riot, and I talked about, I was making the argument that this year marks the 15th anniversary of the audiobook boom. And in 2008, two things happened. Amazon buys Audible and the iPhone gets the App Store so that you can get audiobooks on your phone through arbitrary apps. So that's why I had 2008 on the brain. Anyway, there's something else. Oh, Patreon. After this show, it was on the regular show last week where I was, spitballing.
Yeah. Was it on the regular?
I think it was.
I can't remember if it was here or on the Patreon. We should talk about the idea.
Anyway, so I think it was on the regular show. The idea of some sort of like heat index list of books that are in the whatever, in the ether, in the zeitgeist, and what that might look like. And I got a lot of good feedback about that. People are like, yes, I would like that, but it seems really hard. And I think that is both of those things are true, both for me personally. So I took a stab at the hot 50. That's actually, I think I got it down to 57. And I've got some categories. And on the Patreon episode we're going to record right after this show, that's going to go up on the Patreon next week, you'll hear me giving this to Rebecca Cold and hearing her react and see if I've got my head screwed on anywhere right. And if there's anything to do about it on an ongoing basis, that's on the Patreon, patreon.com/bookriotpodcast. There's a link in the show notes there. I texted Rebecca this and I said I had 50 and she said that seemed like a lot.
And then you said, I got it down from 62.
I got it 62 down to 57 and I'm having a hard time. Well, that's of such things, conversations are made.
Yeah.
But
I'm looking forward to it. I am nervous that you told me there was no prep I should do. So I have refrained from even like reminding myself what big books of previous years were. So we'll see how this goes.
Well, yeah. And I'm just kind of getting it outlined, but I put some ground rules in and there's some like immunity idols. Okay. I don't know how Survivor works. I know that phrase, but like if you get, like here's a free one. If you won the Nobel Prize, you get
list.
To be on the list for a year till the next Nobel All Prize right. is awarded. So that's the kind of stuff I've sketched out.
I'm
and then I've
got
the specific cases. So go check that out. I think it should be a rollicking conversation to talk about
the Hot 50. As they all are.
Yeah, that's right. That's a fair one.
We
let's do our first sponsor break. Oh, good. Anything else?
No, I was just saying we rollick here. That's what we're doing.
Yeah, we do. We do rollick. And then the last Patreon episode was Books of the Year. We each picked, and these weren't our picks. These are like the hot five, I guess, for the year. I guess that's what got us thinking about it ahead of that recording. So good stuff on the Patreon. Go check it out if you haven't already. Let's do a sponsor. Rebecca, I was talking to my brother yesterday who works in Hollywood in post-production. He's a sound engineer. Mm-hmm. And we were talking about, I was asking about the strike, the SAG-AFTRA, I don't know my acronyms quite, AFTRA, went on strike last night joining the WGA. And as you might imagine, the downstream effects for someone in post-productions are both serious and, you know, immutable and also sympathetic. And we were talking about, you know, what's the content waterfall going to look like and how the next, you know, 6 to 12 months, when do you start feeling it from a consumer? And one thing I told him I had been hearing a little bit about the striking writers is, you know, writers can write things other than TV shows and movies.
Yes, they can.
And I wonder if we're going to have like, you know how sometimes, I don't know if this happens anymore, and maybe it never did, but there was this old kind of, I guess really the opposite of an urban myth. This is a rural myth of a big snowstorm in a farming town. Mm-hmm. And then 9 months later, you had
all
a bunch of babies.
Yeah.
I think we might have strike book babies in a year and a half. What do you think of that? Do you think that's possible?
I think it's a reasonable guess. Given some of the reporting I was reading this morning that maybe the Hollywood, you know, folks who are in charge of things are trying to wait it out until the writers are all broke. I'm expecting,
what a tough look
right?
That was.
Yeah, that's all the tough looks. I would be, I think, first expecting like a wave of Substacks, like stuff that will bring immediate cash. Yeah. But that creative juice does need somewhere to go. And book proposals would be an interesting one. I would be really interested, actually, in seeing like novel proposals from the writers of some shows that I love, or short stories or whatever. Give me all your
Kickstarters, YouTube channels. Right. I mean, I'd be curious to see if people try to find some other
places
to put that.
Yeah, that would make a lot of sense. Anyway. We'll see.
We'll see. Let's see. Was there any follow-up? Yeah, it doesn't look like we had too much follow-up of late. So one, a follow-on story. Sarah Silverman, the writer, comedian, performer, actress, is also doing one of these copyright infringement things of both Meta and OpenAI related to using material to train AI. I don't know. Is there anything new in this story other than another drop in the – or another, I guess, soldier falls into the ranks of figuring this out and leaving?
Yeah, and that there – her argument is – the argument that her attorneys are making is the same as the one we discussed last week, that ChatGPT will summarize her books and that infringes on copyright. I'm feeling like I must be missing some critical piece of like how copyright law works.
If I summarize Sarah Silverman's book, am I infringing on her copyright?
Right. And that's the part that's kind of making my head spin a little bit is how is... Yeah. A summary of a book, an infringement on copyright, because that exists in all sorts of reviews. And maybe there's an exception. Maybe it's like how you can make a parody of a thing and that doesn't violate the copyright. So maybe there's like review exceptions in copyright law that I don't know about, but summaries of books are all over the place, and Cliff's Notes exists and Spark Notes and all of those things that summarize and then some. So how is it different if a piece of technology is doing that, other than they didn't give this piece of technology explicit permission to read their book? But as I stated last week, it doesn't need to read their books. It can read all the other summaries on the internet of their books.
Yeah, that's right. I'm missing something too. I wonder if there's a lawyer that would talk to us or something. I mean, I've got a couple of ideas of people I don't know, but it feels a little bit like there's laws yet to be written here. It feels like this – I would be surprised if there's some extant law, statute, guideline, regulation, whatever that's covered this because it seems like it would be strange.
I have all these question marks, and it seems like the two possibilities are either these people don't understand how this works – or there's some critical piece that we are missing here. And I'm willing to believe either of those. But I would love to hear from a copyright attorney. If you listening have a connection to someone that could explain to us what this is really about, that would be super helpful. Mm-hmm. Podcast@bookriot.com. Let us know.
Kelly Jensen wrote, one of the more devastating leads I've seen about book banning and censorship recently. News out of Mississippi that those under the age of 18 in Mississippi will not be allowed to use Hoopla, Overdrive, and Libby without their parents' consent. Kelly's line is, despite the age of consent, and the implied adjective there is sexual consent in Mississippi being 16, no one under the age of 18 will have access to digital materials made available through public and school libraries without explicit parental guardian permission. She does all the code. You understand, like that's what it is. Everyone knows the reason why. Because books are scary and full of bad things, and they should all be buried in under 10 tons of sand like nuclear waste. No, it's that they don't like people knowing things that they don't want them to know, and that this is something apparently there's enough support for in these communities and states, or at least the legislatures can get away with it. I don't know. It's very... I feel every time I'm like, boy, I didn't see this one coming, or I feel extra bad about this, and I continue to be surprised. I did not see this one coming, I have to admit. Under 18. I didn't see this.
This one is a travesty. They're all
You can work in a factory. You can work in a chicken processing plant at 14, but you can't check out any book you want from the library.
You can legally consent to sex and then be forced by the state's reproductive rights restrictions to have a child. So you can become a parent against your will in Mississippi before you can check out a book, before you can check out an ebook from your library. So just deeply and troubling.
And anyone who says, well, you know, this stuff isn't appropriate or they should just check all the books. Here's the thing. What we've learned is that the kind of people behind this, they don't want kids reading the right books.
Right.
That's not what they're after. Even if they were, that's still bad. They don't want, let's move it this way. They don't see any downside just to kids not reading books.
Right.
They're throwing the baby out with the bathwater.
Yeah, they're fine with kids not reading books. That's
they're fine
kind of
with
the
kids
point.
Not reading. Right. Right. And because of the way you can't code every book.
No.
And also there's no agreed upon way of saying what is sexually explicit is not, it's a qualitative, not quantitative.
Right.
And there's too many books and there's too many municipalities for the technology or for library staff to go through with a fine tooth comb and make sure that Jill and Johnny can't read X, but they can Y if they're this state versus that state or this school board or this library system versus that library system. So you get these blanket revocations of fundamental rights based on age and location. And I hope they get sued to oblivion about this. I don't know why. I don't know how they would get sued. I hope someone figure out. I hope the lawyers that are interested in suing big companies for money for OpenAI are as interested in suing the state of Mississippi so that 16-year-olds can read 1984.
Right. Whoever figured out that authors can sue the state of Florida over First Amendment stuff when their books get taken out of classrooms needs to figure out what to do in this situation. It's exactly, specifically about keeping kids from reading, period. And Kelly notes that even if a kid under the age of 18 gets parental permission, they still might not be able to get the material that they want because vendors have to ensure that every item within their offering meets a new wide-reaching definition of obscenity that the state of Mississippi has enacted. And forcing that kind of like bureaucratic labor is also specifically intended to make this impossible. We will keep you if you want. Okay, so you do want to get parental permission and let kids have stuff. We will make it impossible for you to do it because now you're already understaffed. And I believe Mississippi's libraries are underfunded. Where are you going to get people who can ensure that every single item that they make available to those kids who are under 18 and have parental permission meets the criteria that they have set out that are also sufficiently nebulous that you could quibble over any of them in any direction and keep people even further occupied?
Bad news out of Florida as well. Teachers sued the state of Florida, arguing that the application of a certain law covering media centers in schools and certain books being taken off the shelves, the teachers said that should not apply to classroom collections. Like a teacher has, you know, if you've been into a, I assume this is way in private schools, but in public schools, the teachers will also have their own shelf of books. The teachers are arguing that's not the library. A judge in Florida agreed with the state of Florida saying those also are libraries. And so the same rules that are yanking a bunch of books off shelves in the main library for schools also applies to the teachers. Here's a measured tweet from a public servant. Florida Education Commissioner Manny Diaz Jr. tweeted, "Read it and weep. It's sad to see the Florida's teachers union waste their members' hard-earned money on a frivolous lawsuit to block parents from knowing what their children are reading in classrooms. I would argue if the teacher has books on the shelf, you could go visit your teacher's library and see what books are there.
You sure could.
But this is under the same rubric of the knowledge and information and connection and context that are available in books that teachers select for their classrooms and libraries are a threat to the closed-minded and bigoted worldviews of those who don't want people to know things and think things that they don't approve of. And it continues apace. The ray of sunshine here, when Kelly was on the show, she talked about Illinois banning book bans. Mm-hmm. Pennsylvania looks to be following a similar structure for next session. The problem with all of these, of course, maybe, is that it's the blue states that are doing the banning of book bans,
right,
and it's the red states that are
the books.
You know, there's kids there being subject to them. So if you're 16, It depends if you're a red or blue state, and you can choose what you want to read from Libby or Hoopla. So, boy, it just keeps keeping on. It Rebecca, does. I don't know if I have anything at all new to add to any of these, but those are the stories from the assault on libraries in America.
And I think this is going to be the thing we're talking about, at least through next year's election cycle here, and then we'll see what happens. But may your efforts succeed, Pennsylvania senators, in banning the book bans. I just hope to see this continue to catch on, and I am trying to feel a little bit encouraged that we may be starting to see some actually costly backlash against not just the book bans, but like the broader culture war sorts of stuff. Like Florida is not doing great in tourism.
No.
Major sports players are taking their families out of states where their kids aren't safe because of their gender identity or sexuality. Those kinds of decisions can open the door for other people to think, well, if that's what they're doing, I should consider that too. Maybe my family or my company could make that decision. The pocketbook is where it hurts for a state with a policy like this. And at least I think until through the election cycle, that's going to be the way to, or one of the ways to fight back is to, if you're local to those places, run for something, pay attention.
Or get involved in a campaign.
Right.
You know, there's a lot you can do. And you're right, it's going to take the people who are in power getting the signal from their whatever, from their constituencies, their voters, their, frankly, political parties, that this is a losing issue.
Right.
Because there's not a lot of room for sort of federal legislation to come clean this up.
Yeah. And the place I feel, I guess, a little heartened is it has taken the GOP a long time, even if they're figuring it out now, and I'm not sure that they are, to realize that the like the Roe overturning is a losing issue. And they are they have lost elections because of that specifically since last summer. And that continues to be one of the primary tent poles of their messaging in both local and state and federal elections. I think we're going to see it all the way through next year. Yeah. So it might take them a while to figure out that this is a losing issue, but we can make it cost them something in the meantime.
And they're spending their political capital on this, right? I mean, sometimes you win elections so you get to do things you want to do, and spending political capital to overturn, you know, the pyramid of things that had to happen for Roe to get overturned and the pyramid of things that need to happen for a local school board in Florida or Tennessee or Arizona or Texas or wherever, they need to lose or they're going to keep doing it.
Right.
And, you know, there's some, you know, gerrymandering and district stuff around voting, but ultimately it's going to be voting. And if this is an issue you care about, you might think about how your next wave of political engagement might center on it. Mm-hmm. You know, especially if you're in a red state that's going to be red on the Senate or presidential level, maybe don't phone bank for Biden in Tennessee. I don't know. You might think about what the highest and best use of your marginal political activity might be that affects you locally. Or maybe not instead of, but both and. Maybe that's the more generous way of putting it. And even in blue states, like, you know, I'm looking around as the election comes. You don't have to get too far outside of Portland for local school boards to be doing stuff like this. So your state is not a monolith, as we all know, even though it gets portrayed that way by our boy John Kornacki when it comes to electoral night math. But when it comes to school board stuff, it's really local, and it's very lumpy.
Yeah, the school board right next to the county that I live in has an appointed school board by the county commissioners, and that appointed school board is doing all kinds of stuff around books and around policies that affect trans kids. And there was a recent petition to try to get an elected school board, and that got, I mean, fought as vociferously as you would expect it to by the people who want to continue being able to just appoint whoever they want to be in power and to maintain the power that they have. And that kind of, like, that was an uphill battle for people who were very passionate about it, just to be trying to explain it to, you know, folks who aren't super plugged in to what's happening politically. But I think that's the headline right now, is that if, you know, if you are pretty plugged in and there are folks in your orbit that are not at all, or that are only kind of casually paying attention to what's happening in local politics, this is a really critical moment to be educating the folks around you that are open to it and encouraging people to pay attention and giving them resources and making your kinds of resources available in any ways that you can, because it does, it's going to take like the quote unquote, like the normal people who aren't reading a ton of political coverage. It's going to take them paying attention and deciding to vote on things and deciding to show up to school board meetings in order to prevent a small group that do not represent even the entirety of like the Republican Party. This is a losing issue, but it plays well to the base. And if you want to get outside the base having all of the control, then we've got to do our work on our side as well. And that means like some real boots on the ground, grassroots, one-on-one talking to people stuff.
Let's do a sponsor break and maybe some more fun kind of news on the other side. I'm going to clear out for you here. The princess of pop. If Madonna was the queen of pop, it feels like Britney was the princess of pop. Taylor and Beyonce's tours this year are sucking up so much oxygen. Mm-hmm. I feel like, am I at the end of history? I don't know if it's, what's going on? Is the Taylor Swift concert the biggest concert tour that's ever happened in your just like your zeitgeisty sense of the world?
Mm-hmm. Definitely in my zeitgeisty sense of the world, it is, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's hard to remember, and some of this is 90s monoculture, right? That Britney sold, I mean, with the greatest selling artists of all time. She was up there with Michael Jackson, the Beatles, all those kinds of stuff. And what is she doing that you're interested in this
year
that's related to this podcast specifically?
She has a memoir called The Woman in Me that we knew she had gotten a book deal with Gallery Books, which is a Simon & Schuster imprint, for $15 million, which made it one of the biggest deals ever after the Obama's deals. And now it'll be up there with Prince Harry also. It's coming out October 24th. We were waiting for a release date and a title announcement. It happened earlier this week. I think Kelly Jensen, our dear colleague, might be the only person more excited about this than I am. And I'm not even a huge Britney fan in terms of the music or like the content, but who she is and the life that she's led and what's been done to her is fascinating. The opportunity for a celebrity to tell their own story is always, there's always a lot of potential there. I think celebrity memoirs often don't reach that potential because they can be too safe, but Britney has shown over the last couple of years that like she is not scared. She is out from under the conservancy. She's speaking her truth, and I am here for like 300 and some odd pages of Britney Spears' truth. I have pre-ordered it. I think Kelly and I are going to do a segment for one of the shows somewhere about it after we both read or listen to it. This is a big deal. I don't know how it's going to land in terms of publicity. I've been thinking about, like, will it all start to leak out early the way things did with Prince Harry? Will there be big bombs that are dropped? I suspect there's going to be some pretty surprising stuff here, given all that she encountered just coming up in Hollywood as a young woman in the 90s, but also in her very specific and difficult family situation around her money, around who had control of her career. She was really done dirty in a lot of very painful ways. And the chance for her to tell it from her side is really important. And I'm excited about that for her. This feels like justice for Britney, that she's going to, you know, get to spend a couple hundred pages telling it from her perspective. So I'm just very happy for her to get to do this. I want Britney Spears to be okay.
Yeah. So we're going to keep an eye on that.
We are.
And maybe do something around that. I've got a quick hobby horse before we do front list for
sure.
You. If you'll indulge me. We didn't have too much in the way of news items. And I think I was looking at the Hugo finalist list, which were announced in June a couple weeks ago. And I was related to the Hot 50 thing, to be honest.
Okay.
I was looking at the prizes when things were put around. So I was looking at all of them. We need to come together as a book industry. The first thing we need to do is agree that there are three publishing seasons.
Yes.
Summer, fall, and winter. Summer, fall, and spring I'll also allow,
sure.
But three, we're going to choose three of them, and we're going to, that's how the seasons, and that's how the catalogs will be organized.
Done.
After we do this, we're going to come together and agree that if you have a book award, there's two things. One is that all books The eligibility period is a calendar year.
Yes, thank you.
January to December 31st. Book published in that frame is eligible for the award for that year. And secondly, those awards will be given in the first quarter of the subsequent year. So for books published in 2023, all the awards will be announced in Q1 of 2024.
I second all of these emotions.
Because they're all over. You know what the eligibility window for the National Book Award is?
No, but I'm positive that it's weird.
December 1st to November 30th of the next year.
Why?
I guess because they...
It's like... That's like the worst. It's so close to being a calendar year.
I know.
It's 30 days off.
Liberty and I were talking on that episode of First Edition about like the changing rules of publishing, and I still don't understand. And maybe this is related to it. There should be more interesting books released in the first 2 weeks of December than currently are.
Mm-hmm.
People are still buying books. I know people want them out there for the holiday season, but those January 6th releases, I'm sorry, I don't mean January 6th in terms
right.
of that date. Gosh, we've ruined so many. Thanks a lot, all you people out there. That first Tuesday in January has become a pretty good release
it
day.
It really has.
All those books should be released 3 weeks earlier because you know what? You're not selling Christmas version. You're not selling them the next
right.
Christmas.
And
it doesn't do you no good.
Yeah, it doesn't. 50 weeks later, no one's thinking about the book that came out on January 8th or whatever. That's going to be the Prince Harry problem this year. January 10th?
Yes.
Come on. Why was Spare not out on December
2nd? Why was it not? Yes.
As
why
a holiday
not?
Gift. Come on.
Or wait until the next, or I don't know, whatever. But like, you don't know. And I think people think in terms of years. I know this is a very dumb and obvious thing to say, but we've done the books of the year. You look at like movies or TV or music. What books came out this year? This stuff is wild. The Emmys have a weird eligibility window, and maybe it doesn't matter. But like, I really feel like the year is the unit of time we've agreed upon, and that's a good unit. But let's keep to that,
well,
and then we can understand what's happening.
I think that's right. I'm sure that these developed with these weird windows by some some strange process where maybe they
yeah.
didn't foresee that they were going to be stuck with these windows forever. We're developing the National Book Award and we're going to have the party in November or whenever they have it.
Yeah.
So this is the eligibility window. But like, you could move those things or you could just make it about the books from the previous calendar year. I really support all of this. I would be willing to extend the award giving window into Q2 if the committees need enough time to read everything from the previous year. But once you get past like June of this year, no one wants to talk about the books that came out last year. It already feels like it's very long sometimes. Like by the time the Pulitzer stuff comes out, I'm like, what year did that book come out? When did it win the award? How? I like all of these. I support this hobby horse for you.
It just feels like, I don't know. It's so hard to know what goes where. But I do think, and one of the things I'm thinking about too, is like getting the Golden Globe, say what you will. But like there's an award season in movies, and the pointy end of that is the Oscars,
yes.
right? But they're all dealing with the same eligibility window. So they're like, did this win? Does this win? What does it mean? And there gets momentum to be talk about, these 5, 10 best pictures and the performances and that, like it gives the whole industry, say what you will about the erosion of the Oscars as a platform, but compared to the platforming or the shared platforming to books, mm-hmm. it looks like a dreadnought.
It does.
It looks like, Dwight D. Eisenhower and NATO rolling into Normandy.
That's a well-oiled machine over there.
Yeah, it looks, but I feel like the book industry would really benefit from a similar award season window in conversation.
I
and this
so
won
too.
This. Does that mean they're going to win this? And who's going to win that? But now it's all over the place. And the Pulitzer Prizes and the National Books and the National Books Critics Circle Award. And I know books are weird because they take a long time to read and there's so many of them. I totally get that. But everyone has the same problem. Let's just all get on the same literal and figurative pages here about when we're going to do these.
Yeah.
So that's my hobby horse. If you're a birdie out there, and there are, everyone has their reasons. That's one thing I've learned about being an adult, is that it's not just that you are the first person to think about this in the industry of you're no part of or only tangentially, and everyone that hears it is like, you know what, Jeff? You're right. Why didn't we think of that 50 years ago, the thousands of us that work in this? But if there is some reason that I don't get, Or, and, but also I've learned that sometimes it's inertia in how we do things. Those are both a twin. That's the dialectic I have to have in my head about all things. Sometimes everyone has their reasons. There's things that you don't understand, and they may be nonsensical to you, or you wish they weren't the case, but often there are reasons. And then sometimes, enough of the time, it's like, that's just the way they do things.
Yep.
And these are all a federation. I get that, getting them in line. But I guess if I was the czar of books, this is one thing I'd really get behind.
I would do this too. And I think that that would maybe smooth out some of the lumpiness in the quality of new releases over the course of the year. She says in the middle of July, when new titles that are exciting are kind of in short supply. Probably because the fall and now the like early winter are the windows in which people are putting out stuff that they think is for like serious consideration. I think some of that has to do with our ideas about reading in terms of like cold weather and people being inside and mental models of vacation reads and all of that. But just paying, like, for the years that I hosted all the books with Liberty, and now that we are doing front list and I'm just paying attention to what books are coming out, like, it is really lumpy. There's not like an even number of books put out every week.
No.
And there's definitely not an even distribution of the exciting new titles across a year. And I would like to see some of that as well, just for also like more evenness of reading life. That would be nice. That's one of my movements as czar. Spread them out.
Yep. Okay. Let's do front list foyer,
okay.
Rebecca.
All right.
What have you been reading?
I've got a twofer of like rich people problems, families fall apart stuff. Which is perfect for me for the summer. The first is Little Monsters by Adrienne Brodeur. I read her memoir Wild Game a couple of years ago. It was about the affair that her mother had like throughout her childhood and treated Adrienne as her confidant through it. I remember talking about it as like, you think your mom has boundary problems? And this is a novel about a family on Cape Cod from a bunch of their perspectives. The patriarch is an aging, preparing to retire, a famous marine biologist. There's a son who is like a successful businessman thinking about a political career, a daughter who is an artist on the edge of her big break. And then there is another character in a different state who is discovering that the father that she was raised with is not her father. Indeed, the marine biologist is her father.
Oh, boy.
And is she going to drop herself into this family and blow things up or not? What other secrets are lurking in this family? How will they find out about them? It is just family secrets coming out left and right. I loved it. It's juicy and well-written, like exactly what I want from a book like that. And I continue to think that the gold standard of this is Maggie Shipstead's Seating Arrangements, which manages to be like really sharp and funny and right on about family dynamics. This comes pretty close. I really, really enjoyed it. The other one I'm almost finished with is a new novel by Andrew Ridker called Hope. I picked it up because I saw it comped to Fleischman Is in Trouble, which I really loved.
Emmy nominated.
Yeah.
By the way.
Yes.
Lots of Emmys.
Well
for
deserved. Fleischman was great. I really liked that adaptation. But this is a novel about family in Brookline, Massachusetts, you know, in one of the ritzy suburbs. Dad is a doctor. He's involved in a research project that is not going super well. Mom is having an affair with a woman in the neighborhood, and the affair is kind of known, but nobody knows if it's like inside the bounds of their marriage or not. Like, maybe they have an open marriage and nobody knows. Stuff is going on with their kids as well. And then also secrets come out. We also move, each section of the book moves between a different character. Jeff, I have to warn you that there is your favorite trope in this of teacher has affair with student, and it's a high school student. So that happens.
Wonderful. Even better.
Fits right inside the whole like family scandal model for the book, though. And the thing, like, it's really biting and very fun. The dialogue in it is amazing. The family is Jewish, and I saw it written up as like one of like the pinnacle of modern Jewish novels. I cannot, like, I can't judge that. I'm not Jewish.
You're not on the committee that decides these things, right. Is what you're saying?
I am not on this committee. But having just come off of watching Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret, there is a grandmother in this book that I can hear her voice in Kathy Bates's voice of the grandmother in Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret. Like, just that same kind of tone. But the best part is that the daughter works in publishing, and the publisher she works for is called Dunning-Kruger Press.
Yes. Incredible.
I almost texted you that the other day. Like, look at this amazing stuff. But I decided to save it for the show. It's wonderful. Like, this is my first time reading Andrew Ridker, but it's like a great sense of humor that I'm really enjoying. Like, none of his characters are safe from him, but I think everyone is treated pretty humanely. And the exploration of the mom's queer relationship and her understanding of her sexual identity is so far, I think, being handled pretty well. I'm near the end of it. I'll finish it tonight, but I'm far enough in that I can recommend it. What have you been up to?
So I'm going to the coast for a few nights, and I want to take a big chunky book that I've been meaning to get to. So I picked up The Covenant of Water.
Have you heard of it?
You know, the phone book. I thought it was the phone book for a minute. And I was lucky enough to get a galley. You facilitated that. And galleys aren't as always economical. Like, I think it's even bigger than the hardback because they use different kinds of paper and formatting or whatever.
But at least it's not a hardcover to carry around.
No, it's true. But, and I, you know, I don't like to start a book on vacation because, like, it's hard to get started. So I wanted to, like, get into it a little bit. So, you know, I started, I'm 250 pages in, which for that book means I'm just getting underway. Like, I'm just getting stretched out.
Yep. You're warmed
so
up.
So I'm into that. I have a theory. I don't know what to call it. So two books I read back to back, and I don't think it did them any favors to read them back to back.
That happens.
Directions to Myself by Heidi Julewicz and The Light Room by Kate Zimbrino. Authors both I really like. I don't think it helps that they were both sort of doing, kind of doing similar things. You know, New York writing, you know, professional writers, wonderful stylists who teach in MFA programs that have young kids. That was just, both of them did similar things. The Lightroom is a little bit more about COVID, which, as listeners and you know, I now have a very high bar for writing about COVID. It's a very high bar.
I was going
to
say, I'm surprised to hear that you had picked that up because I was sort of circling it and the COVID.
I like Zambrino, so I'm going to give her the benefit of the doubt to try. And I don't regret reading it. It's not bad at all. It's like, this is a different thing. And some of it could be personal, which most of these things are that we don't like to admit. But my bar for very good stylists just kind of writing about the last few years of their life with no specific direction is also a very high bar. And I think I need a little bit more now. I think a little bit more than this. It's not enough to be a good writer. Your life that you're just experiencing, to me, is not interesting enough by itself to want to stick around with you for 300 pages.
Is that made worse by the life that they're talking about over the last couple of years is similar in really like important and inescapable ways from the life all of us lived over the last 3 years?
The Julewicz, in fairness, doesn't do COVID stuff. But it's, you know, and there's some really wonderful parts of both of them, but it's a little bit like, well, I need to, the uncharitable reading of this, which is, I am loath to do, which is, I want to write a book. What am I working on? Well, I'll write about my life and my kids over the last few years. And I love my life and my kids. They're very interesting to me. But I think I need a higher bar. I need a little bit more something there. And I think the other thing, and maybe going into this too, and I don't know if this has been coined, probably someone has written about this in the Paris Review or somewhere, I don't know. There is also an emerging non-fictional character in memoirs by well-meaning literary people that are spoused up, who have spouses that are non-problematic. And they exist in these books as sort of like Hamlet's ghost. they're like kind of around. And they'll like make an appearance for a line or two, but they're just not germane to what's happening. It's a very odd move. And I've seen it enough times now that it feels like a recognizable literary device in narrative nonfiction of a certain ilk to have the present, non-problematic, but completely uninvestigated, portrayed or characterized partner that's just sort of like, there.
Oh, and this guy was here for a little bit of it. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's not about them, but it has to also be about them because it's about their life. Yeah. So it's like this very weird, like there's a veil over this person that, especially if you're, you know, in Manhattan in COVID, is like in your personal space like 99% of the time. And yet they're this kind of like literary, psychological, emotional phantasm that the reader can't quite touch or understand. It's completely walled off. And so if you're not going to give me to that, it kind of feels like a pantomime of a memoir of some kind.
I think that's a great point.
I'm looking for that.
I've read a few of those as well. And it's always especially weird when you get like halfway through a book like that and they mention their partner for the first time and you're like, right. Oh, there's this whole other person who is part of this. And right, you're telling a deeply personal story, largely about domestic life, especially COVID, in which like the first year was just domestic life all the time in every avenue, and to just not mention or depict. And maybe some of it is like respecting partners' privacy, and I get that, but I think
that's almost 100% of it. I completely agree. But as a reader, I don't care. Right. That's not my problem.
That bears a like, okay, if in order to respect your partner's privacy, you have to just like kind of distort the story of what was going on in life at the time, then you just need to pick a different story to tell.
Or I can't go there. You're just choosing not to go there, right? And it's very difficult. And this may not be a fair reading. I haven't gone line by line. Maybe there's a moment in Zimbrino. I know there's one point she talks about fighting with her partner for a page or something like that. And I don't think I'm creating a narrative in retrospect. But a lot of our experience who were spoused up or, you know, potting together or whatever to call it, like the story was that you couldn't go other places. But the story that story creates is I'm with these people all the time. All the time. And if you're going to write, if you're going to rely upon the strength of your prose to tell about a fairly quotidian existence, you've really got to get into it to make it interesting to me. So that's frontlist foyer with a rant / inventing a narrative. I need a name for this. I think it's like Beneficent Ben, the Beneficent Ben character.
He's supportive and he respects your career.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
Also, but doesn't seem like he's helping out that much, though. I mean, I just don't know. I'm just not sure. It's like the Beneficent Ben character. I'm coining that now.
I love it. Well, I hope you have a good time at the coast, and I look forward to the like 19 TikToks that you'll have to make as you move through each section of the Covenant of Water, because that seems to be.
I tell you one thing about Covenant of Water. If you're a character in an Abraham Verghese book, you're going to get a boil. You're going to get an absence. You're going to get an aneurysm, some sort of cancer, tropical disease.
Novels written by physicians set in times before modern medicine are just brutal in that way.
Well, my dad was a doctor, an eye doctor, and I know that it's like anyone sees the world through their lens, and the lens of doctors, like seeing the things they've seen happen to the parts of bodies for which they are responsible.
Yep.
My dad understands the world largely as a set of externalities trying to get into your cornea. and so I get that, but it is there a book by a doctor has more maladies than you're going to. It's not an interpreter of maladies, it's a descriptor and cataloger of maladies is what you get with Abraham Verghese.
The librarian of maladies, that's what you mean.
Because
if you put librarian in a title, you can sell that.
Yeah, the librarian of maladies of Paris.
There you go.
The secret librarian. Anyway, we can continue doing this. All right, Rebecca, thanks so much. Bookriot.com/listen. Go check out First Edition. Go check out the Patreon. If you've read a book with a beneficent Ben, I'd sure like to know it. Am I right? Have you read these books?
Yeah.
You know, I need some external validation out there from Rebecca and everybody else. So give me an email back as well. Rebecca, thank you as always.